Welcome to All Things New Orleans. This week, host Jack Hopke has kindly turned the microphone over to WWNO's Coastal Desk. I'm Coastal reporter Jesse Hardman.
And I'm Coastal producer Lane Kaplan-Levinson.
Well, welcome to you all. Welcome.
This is the 24th Annual Society of Environmental Journalists Conference took place in New Orleans last week, bringing to town a few hundred environmental reporters, advocates, scientists, engineers, politicians, and more. Participants got out of the conference rooms to see the levees, bayous, marshes, sinkholes, refineries, and rivers that all contribute to the complex region known as Louisiana's Gulf Coast.
The theme of the get-together was risk and resilience, a nod to the difficult last decade for Louisiana's coastal areas, which have weathered devastating hurricanes and the worst oil spill in U.S. history. A lot of the conference was about trying to define complicated terms like, what does resilience mean?
What is this business of resilience that is so popular today? Why is it so squishy? Where does it come from? What does it mean?
That's Roger Mark D'Souza, the Director of Population, Environmental Security, and Resilience at the Woodrow Wilson Center located in Washington, D.C.
I think it's squishy to the degree that it is used so often now, and it is sometimes considered to be a catch-all phrase for anything related to climate or the environment or vulnerability or people's ability to adapt. So folks are a little tired of hearing the term because they're not quite sure how it's defined and what it really means in terms of making a difference to people's lives.
D'Souza spoke on a panel at the conference called Risky Cities and Resilient Communities. The discussion touched on climate change and migration on a global level. I caught D'Souza afterwards to hear his thoughts on the Louisiana coast.
So resilience as a term in a coastal context is particularly important today because it talks about vulnerability. It puts in place a framework for planning for action. And it is a concept and a general idea that people can understand once they appreciate how it's being used.
And what does it mean to be resilient for a place that is being told that it's eroding away?
Yeah, this is something that I've heard not only in communities here in the United States, but in countries like Bangladesh. Bangladesh is one of the most resilient countries there is, but are they better off? That is the sort of a key question. So you can be resilient, but is resiliency a measure of an improvement in life? So I think when we have a community that is saying to us, you know, we're tired of being resilient, what they're saying is we're tired of being battered and we survive, but we're not moving forward. And this is exactly where the resilience movement and planning is now. We're not talking about just bouncing back. It's how do you bounce back better? And the only way that you can bounce back better is you plan for these shocks. So you know they're going to happen. You plan for them and you put in place mechanisms. You put in place systems. You put in place financial support so that communities are able to bounce back better. So I think when you hear communities say, you know, we're tired of being resilient, it's okay, enough. We're resilient. We know that. Thank you. But how do we move on? And this is where we are. How do we get beyond that?
So finally, why do you think this year's Environmental Journalism Conference is in New Orleans? And how do you see what's happening in Louisiana in terms of the larger picture of talking about resiliency and climate?
I think it's quite significant that the Society of Environmental Journalists meeting is in New Orleans this year. Emotionally, it's a really good place for people to come back and reflect on these issues because there's stories from the front lines. It makes a difference to be here. It means something to be here. It is real and concrete. These are no longer abstract shocks that are happening to us. I was recently chatting with a journalist from Fiji, and he said to me, Roger Mark, how do we get the American public to understand what's happening to our small island states or internationally and get them to act? And part of our discussion was coming to places like New Orleans, where it has happened, where people are dealing with it, where people feel a sense of urgency, and it sends a very powerful and visible message of regeneration generation and possibility and what needs to happen. This is the new reality, and New Orleans is at the forefront of it. And that has resonated within the country and globally. So it's quite significant for the SEJ to be here and to build on these messages with the journalists who are important messengers of the pressing issues of our time.
That was Roger Mark D'Souza, the Director of Population, Environmental Security, and Resilience at the Woodrow Wilson Center located in Washington, D.C.
Interesting interview, Lane. He did a nice job of defining a term that we hear so much but rarely have explained to us. In fact, that same word was wrapped up in a cool bus tour we helped out on as part of the conference.
Participants could pick one of 9 issue-oriented coastal tours to spend the day on. Jesse and I stayed local and took the tour called The Long Road Home, Community Resilience, Adaptations, and Legacies from America's Biggest Rebuild.
Hey everyone, welcome. I just wanted to mention one important thing. We sort of set the stage.
Our first stop was the Lower Ninth Ward. We met up with David Lessinger, Director of Planning and Strategy for the New Orleans Redevelopment Authority.
There's shade over here by the cypress trees if y'all want to try and find some. I know it's hot.
A city agency that helps with issues related to urban renewal. Anyway. With the Make It Right Homes as a backdrop, Lessinger talked about the work that's gone into helping families come back to neighborhoods like the Lower Ninth and what will help make areas that were hardest hit by Katrina more resilient in the future.
The Road Home Program is the largest housing program in our nation's history, $9 billion. It covers Louisiana, Mississippi, all those states and areas affected by Katrina and Rita, which some people forget about, was also a major hurricane that took place right after Katrina. And it was designed to help people return and rebuild. And so your options were to take a grant to rebuild your home. And many people did that. The vast majority of people did that. Your other option was to sell your house back to the state. And so in this case, the state of Louisiana set up a holding entity, the Road Home Corporation, or also known as the Louisiana Land Trust, you hear people refer to it as, to be the entity to actually purchase those homes or those properties from the individuals who chose to not return to that piece of ground. It doesn't mean that they didn't return to the city or to the state in some way or another, but they chose to not return to that particular property. And so there was a big chunk of funding that went into just buying individuals' homes. So there was a voluntary decision that people made to not return. And so the land that you're standing on now is one of those properties. Somebody chose to sell this property to the state. And then what took place is that individual parishes took on the responsibility of managing those properties and returning them to commerce, selling them back to other people who are interested in buying them. And so the partnership that you see here with Make It Right is a really important one to us. And 150 units spread out over a huge area is a drop in the bucket, but 150 units in a concentrated area, it makes all the difference in the world because now you're in a neighborhood, right? And so we're so thrilled to be able to support that by selling these properties to Make It Right at as discounted as possible so that they can put those savings into building high-quality, energy-efficient homes for the individuals who are going to come back. The Road Home Program established fair market value by the pre-storm appraised value. Now, how do you determine pre-storm appraised value when the thing's destroyed? It's very difficult. And in fact, there was a class action lawsuit about this because it was determined to be discriminatory against majority African American neighborhoods, exactly because the values were depressed in those neighborhoods. And so it ended up affecting a protected class. So people were then compensated on top of their lowered value. So that was a huge challenge and a huge, still continues to be a challenge.
Welcome to the Mississippi River, people.
All right, so we're on the Mississippi River levee. It goes from the mouth of the river behind me.
Darrell Malik Wiley's also been active in helping communities recover after Hurricane Katrina. Wiley joined the Sierra Club in 1972 and has worked as an environmental organizer ever since. His main points of interest are toxics, pollution, and environmental health. But Wiley's a guy who knows a lot about a lot. He jumped up on the levee in Holy Cross to share a few facts about the river, Herbert Hoover, and the only 2 steamboat houses in the world.
So, the Mississippi River flood in 1927 changed federal policy on the Mississippi River. The 27 flood helped Herbert Hoover become president because during the flood, he was the head of the Red Cross. He was sending out press releases every day. His name was all across the country, and all of a sudden he became president. Who could have thought? The river right here, 150 to 80 feet deep. There's a lot of water coming by here every second. There are companies looking at the possibility of putting in turbines for energy and a whole range of things. So right over here, we have a house called the Steamboat House. There's one there and one behind it that you'll be able to see as we get closer. There are two in the world. One, two. It's a unique structure. The gentleman who built it was a steamboat captain. He went to the World's Fair in St. Louis in 1904. He saw a Japanese pagoda, so that influenced somewhat the tuck of the roof coming up. But he also designed it when he built that house, this levee was not as high. And being a river captain, he knew that the river would flood on a regular basis. He designed his house to flood. The bottom floor is all glazed brick. It's got ceramic tile on the floor. When the flood, when the river floods, you know when the peak's coming towards you. You take all your furniture upstairs, open the windows, doors, let the water go through, come back with a hose. You're good to go. If they could do that in 1904, why the hell can't we do it now? And we're gonna walk on down some more. Keep walking.
The bus continued on past Chalmette and entered New Orleans East to visit the Veggie Farmers Cooperative. Veggie aims to increase food access and promote sustainable agriculture in the East, an area left without basic resources like food and health care after Katrina. Project manager Daniel Nguyen filled the group in on some of these struggles.
Food access is a huge issue. So did y'all take Chef Highway coming into New Orleans East? So if y'all saw the Winn-Dixie, that was for a while the only grocery store for the entire Orleans East area. So if you imagine 60% of Orleans Parish, only one grocery store, and that grocery store actually took 2 years to rebuild. So you kind of imagine the degree of lack of food access in New Orleans East. So these are issues on top of healthcare access. So before Katrina, there were five hospitals here. Now there's zero. They actually just opened the first one after Katrina. So you can imagine this is almost 10 years after Katrina, and they finally, the city, was able to actually open up the first hospital. So before that, people actually, there were no ambulatory stations stationed out here. So if you had a heart attack, for example, needed ambulatory care, you had to wait for an ambulance to come 30 minutes from the city, receive attention, and then package you to send you 30 minutes back into the city to the nearest hospital. So that's also another big issue, was healthcare access. So that's Katrina in a nutshell. And fast forward to 2010 with the oil spill. So a lot of our folks were engaged not only in the fishing industry to feed their families, but also to engage in some sort of economic livelihood. So overnight, in April 20th, 2010, those folks were unemployed from the oil spill. A lot of our folks were placed out of work and engaging in actual cleanup. So actually folks went out touching the crude oil and cleaning it up, facing unknown kinds of like health impacts. But the biggest issue was the combination of environmental impact on the seafood and then the potential of carrying that over into human consumption. One of the biggest concerns after the oil spill that wasn't being addressed by the government was, is our seafood safe? A lot of the research folks, and even like the government folks, you know, from NOAA and whatnot, were, you know, testing seafood. Intentions weren't bad, but a lot of our folks are saying they're taking samples from places we actually don't get our shrimp from. It doesn't matter if the data is correct or not, if the seafood is really safe or not, but if the data that's being produced isn't being trusted by community members, then it may as well not be even exist, you know? So I think it's very analogous to like, what do you call it? Galileo and the sun, you know? Like, yeah, we actually revolve around the sun, but at the time, you know, no one believed him, so it doesn't really matter. So that was the kind of the same mentality that we were facing after the oil spill, because a lot of government folks were coming in and saying, you know, oil doesn't exist anymore, all that kind of stuff. There was breeding a lot of distrust between researchers and the government officials and the fisher folks. So, you know, even if folks were coming out with data that was right, it wasn't being trusted. So this whole community-based participatory research model was designed to mend relationships and actually engage community members in testing what they want to test and creating data that they want to trust and having community members themselves disseminate it. So we eventually had a lot of community forums and actually decided to test shrimp, for example, was our main focal point. We actually engaged in community members going out there, collecting the research, coming back into the labs, seeing how the research is done itself, getting the data back and disseminating it to community members. So that's kind of some of the models that we've been using in terms of addressing the environmental impacts of Dolisville. And what we're at now is we're trying to do it.
While David Wynn is focused on getting New Orleans East residents involved in creating resilience for their specific community, David Wagner is trying to get the entirety of New Orleans to view the city in a new way. As an architect, Wagner's been instrumental in pushing a plan that will refashion New Orleans as a city that incorporates water, instead of a city that simply tries to keep water out.
The question of whether the city is able to redevelop itself out here in the low-lying areas is, to me, at risk. New Orleans is not a cheap place to live. This is not a Toronto or a Detroit, even, that can stay for decades and centuries on its own. This takes constant maintenance. Once you build a levee system, you have to maintain it, right? So we're perpetually a place of maintenance now. How do you maintain something? Who pays to maintain something? It takes more people, right? So it's not this kind of condition where you can say, well, it's fine the way it is, 380,000 people, they're gonna be fine, they'll be able. No, we can't afford. We need more people, or more revenue, or some other way to pay for living here. I was in Beijing a couple days ago, 3 days ago, and you know, they don't have any water. They have to catch all the water, right? Everybody's got to deal with this water resource in different ways. But if you don't manage it locally, if you don't appreciate it locally, and this is a place where the lesson is not easy, because we have excess. When you have excess, you tend to devalue. When you've been flooded, it's a problem. You don't know how to manage it. So therefore, the Dutch inspiration, right? You know, people said to New Orleanians, you know, maybe the Dutch said, maybe you should try floating houses. And people here said, well, you know, we've had floating houses, and that's not exactly what we had in mind, right? So the process of working with the Dutch is always about, well, what's appropriate here?
During the bus trip, news broke about a ruling on the BP lawsuit. This added a layer of intrigue to a speech given the night before at the conference. Take us there, Jesse.
The ballroom of the New Orleans Hilton was packed with reporters in town for the Society of Environmental Journalists Conference.
You can interrupt the speech from Marcellus.
Jeff Morrell stepped to the podium.
Thank you for that introduction, Mark, and thanks to the Society of Environmental Journalists for...
Morrell's the spokesperson for British Petroleum, otherwise known as BP, and he wanted to share a new narrative about the 4 years that have passed since the oil spill.
That the apocalyptic forecasts of the death of the Gulf, the coastal economy, indeed, the unique way of life here did not come to pass.
Morrell quieted the reporters. Going on the offensive, he cross-examined media coverage that predicted long-term environmental damage along the Gulf Coast.
The oil didn't make it to Tampa, let alone the beaches of Normandy. Gulf shrimp landings didn't take generations to rebound. They quickly returned to pre-spill levels. The spill didn't strike out Louisiana's brown pelicans.
Morrell asserted that a naturally resilient coast and a quick-acting BP team saved the day. Reporters didn't agree.
And I'm going to challenge you a little bit on what you said there, on 2 points that go together. And
the following morning, news hit that BP's viewpoint wasn't shared by the U.S. District Court judge in charge of the case either.
It's a long-awaited ruling. On Thursday, a federal judge said that BP's willful misconduct and gross negligence led to the worst offshore oil spill in U.S. history.
By electing to charge BP with gross negligence, federal judge Carl Barbier opens the company up to as much as $18 billion in new civil penalties. The energy giant has already spent $28 billion in settling claims and cleanup costs. One of the plaintiffs in the BP case was the federal government. United States Interior Secretary Sally Jewell says she watched the ruling closely.
As a plaintiff in that case, we were happy to see the strength of his ruling. We also know that the wheels of justice move slowly and that these are very complicated cases, and BP has already said they're planning to appeal.
Instead of relying on litigation, Secretary Jewell says she'd like to see more mitigation from the energy companies working in the Gulf. Specifically, inserting coastal protection and restoration measures as preconditions to activities like drilling for oil. She says a healthy marsh helps them plan, too.
Companies look for clarity and certainty. They want to be able to develop. They want to know the time frame. And I would say that mitigation is an important cost of doing business that they understand. So if we can make that predictable for them and we can make their dollar for mitigation go farther by hitting areas that are really, really important for a variety of reasons, then I think we both win.
Natalie Perrinen is with the D.C.-based nonprofit Environmental Defense Fund. She's the science policy director for Mississippi River Delta Restoration. Instead of appealing the court ruling, Perrinen says BP should set an example by making that money available as soon as possible.
Pay the fines, to understand the damages that was caused by their actions, their grossly negligent actions, and to pay the money for restoration and get it moving and get it started so that they really truly will make it right in the Gulf.
Perrinen's hoping some of BP's billions in claims and fines will help fund Louisiana's 2017 Master Plan for Coastal Restoration. She helped draft the $50 billion plan and says oil companies should support it.
Some oil and gas really starting to understand, and they're going to continue to evolve as the effects of climate change on their infrastructure, the effect of land loss on their infrastructure, that pipelines are exposed, their risks are getting higher. And so they need restoration just as much as everybody else does.
Last week's ruling placed 67% of the blame for the Macondo well explosion on BP. 30% went to Transocean, and Halliburton, which recently announced a $1 billion settlement for its part in the disaster, was responsible for the remaining 3% of the damages. The federal trial includes three phases. Judge Barbier has yet to rule on the amount of oil spilled into the Gulf, part of a second phase of the trial that happened last fall. The third and last phase will begin in January 2015. That ruling pertains to penalties related to the Federal Clean Water Act.
Will be interesting to see how all of this shakes out.
Yeah, and how much of this money will be put back into restoring the coast.
One of the voices in your feature was Interior Secretary Sally Jewell.
Yeah, she came down from D.C. to visit a few coastal restoration projects. We were lucky enough to get a few one-on-one minutes with the secretary so we could see what's on her mind in regards to Louisiana's coast and her national goals for the environment.
We now know what the consequences are of a devastating storm here or a devastating spill. We're certainly taking actions when it comes to preventing future oil spills. We're learning from those lessons. What can we learn from the lessons of the storms that happened here? The Louisiana Master Plan is a good example of that. Louisiana has been very forward-thinking and has applied some really good science to say we believe we have a solution by applying the lessons of science and Mother Nature to our future. This is what it's going to cost. When you look at the infrastructure and the importance of this region to the economy of the U.S., with the shipping interests, with the oil and gas interests offshore, this is a very, very important region, and it's a region that would benefit from those preventive measures that I believe can be taken, and of course a number of them have been taken since the last storm. So I applaud Louisiana for its forward-thinking nature and its master plan, and I applaud my colleagues in the federal family as well as folks in the state of Louisiana for actually demonstrating that it can work and making good progress already.
Well, I don't know about you, Lane, but that's a lot of information packed into 20 minutes. The data marsh in my brain is receding.
Really? I can't get enough. But then again, I am younger than you.
If you want more information on coastal issues and the Society of Environmental Journalists Conference, head to our website, wwno.org, and keep your ears on 89.9 FM, New Orleans Public Radio. See you on the coast, Lane.
Don't forget your life vest.
Support for WWNO comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection, presenting From Cameo to Close-Up Louisiana in Film, an exhibition exploring Louisiana's history with the silver screen from the early 1900s through the 1990s. Open Tuesday through Saturday at 410 Charter Street. More at hnoc.org. Support for WWNO comes from Reginelli's Pizzeria, with seven locations throughout the metro area, offering an expanded new menu, including classic and contemporary options like garlic knots, a ham, pear, and brie sandwich, and a traditional margarita pizza. More information, including catering and delivery options, at reginellis.com.
From the campus of the University of New Orleans, broadcasting in HD, this is your source for NPR News, great classical music, jazz, and more. 89.9 WWNO New Orleans and 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux Houma. You can learn more about all of WWNO's online live webcasts and expanded HD programming at wwno.org.